Welcome, this is James Corbett, and you are tuned into CorbettReport.com on the 27th of February, 2013. Today we're joined on the line by James Petras, a Bartle Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Binghamton University, New York, who is the author of over 62 books in 29 languages and more than 600 articles in professional journals, including the American Sociological Review, British Journal of Sociology, Social Research, and Journal of Peasant Studies. He's been published in numerous periodicals, including the New York Times, The Guardian, The Nation, Christian Science Monitor, and many, many others besides. But perhaps of more relevance to my listenership, he has also been widely republished on websites like BoilingFrogsPost.com and GlobalResearch.ca. So, Professor Petras, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us today.
I look forward to this interview.
Well, today I wanted to talk about something that is oft neglected in the types of economic and geopolitical stories that we cover here on the Corbett Report, and much to our detriment, I would say. And in that regard, you had an article that was republished on Global Research on the 2nd of October 2011, Latin America, Growth, Stability, and Inequalities, Lessons for the U.S. and EU, in which you wrote, quote, "The image of Latin America portrayed by the mass media and held by the educated public is a region of frequent coups, periodical revolutions, perpetual military dictatorships, alternating boom and bust economies, and an ever-present International Monetary Fund dictating economic policy. In contrast, the same opinion makers plus their academic counterparts project images of the United States and the European Union as stable societies with steady economic growth, incremental expansion of social welfare programs, resolving issues via consensual compromises, and practicing sound fiscal policies." And as you go on in that article to note, I think with some degree of detail, that in fact the image is almost on its head, is certainly if we look at the past 10 years of stultification of the economy in the US and EU and a relative boom in Latin America, which has been largely ignored. And now we stand almost 2 years or at least a year and a half later from the time in which you wrote that article. Do you stand by that assessment? Do you think the outlook looks similar at this point in time, or have things changed somewhat on the economic scale for Latin America?
There's been some modifications. Brazil has slowed down from 5.5% to 6% growth to about 2%. But unemployment is still down to record levels of 4%, something of great envy in Europe and the United States. Argentina has experienced some problems with inflation and a greater degree of polarization, though the country continues to grow largely based on demand. International demand for its agricultural mining products. Ecuador's doing very well, growing a 5.5%. Stable government. The president was reelected with record majority, 57%. Rafael Correa. Venezuela is going through a bit of a bump here because of Chavez's illness. The economy, though, is relatively stable, growing at about 3%. Oil prices are still high. So we can say that the general picture is one perhaps of a slower growth, political stability, and no great coups or revolution on the horizon. There is some problems in regard to Central America, which is essentially experienced horrendous crime rates in Mexico with over 70,000 people killed, and in Salvador and Guatemala, the heavy drugs. And that's a troubling area. But as far as the political processes, elections still go on. There are harsh repressions in Honduras, a militarized country that did have a military coup, a civilian military coup backed by the Obama regime, and build-up of military bases by the U.S. is not very promising. But the world market conditions and Latin America's insertion is crucial here. High commodity prices have buoyed the economies of Peru, Bolivia, Ecuador, and Chile. The high agricultural prices have had a positive impact on Uruguay and Brazil and Argentina. Colombia is moving in a big direction toward mining, and there's serious conflicts in the coffee, cocoa, and agricultural area, largely because of the liberalizing policies of the government. And the positive side is that Colombia and government finally decided to sit down and negotiate with the insurgents, with the guerrillas, the main guerrilla group. That still remains an open question. The fighting goes on, the conflicts are there. Yet Colombia has mended fences with Venezuela, so that's a plus. Now, what's behind all this is, of course, Asia. The enormous demand in China and to a lesser degree India, Korea, and for precisely the commodities that Latin America is specializing in. Now, many critics said this was very temporary, it was a boom and bust, but we're seeing at least a mega cycle that is not the 2 or 3 years of commodity-induced growth followed by a collapse in prices and social unrest and political instability. That cycle has largely been modified and some would say eliminated. China shows no let-up in its high growth. It's heading for another 8% at least this year, largely based on imports of precisely the products that Latin America is producing. So I think the diversification of Latin American markets, the high prices, the orthodox fiscal policies. There's no great accumulation of foreign debts or even domestic debts. A lot of the governments are regulating some of the revenues in a fashion to redistribute, or better said, increase their social expenditures. So while capital grows and profits, the salaried and wage classes can negotiate and, through some trade union struggles, secure increases in salaries and social spending. So you have a kind of implicit social pact that accompanies the primary exporting country, which is the new equation. Previously, we thought of primary exporters as oligarchs and enclaves, but the intervention of these center-left governments has sort of ameliorated and balanced off trade earnings, agro-mineral profiteering with decrease in poverty and increase in the minimum wage and reinvesting some of the money into social programs. Now, there are areas of serious conflict, particularly countries with Indian populations that are affected by mining extraction and toxicity from agribusiness. That's true in the interior of Argentina. It's true in the highlands of the Andes, particularly Peru and Ecuador. So there continue to be social conflicts. Some of the business and banking elites are unhappy and still looking for a way to subvert the government in Venezuela. And as I said, in Mexico, on the surface, you have political stability, but in the society, you have a virtual class war or high levels of civil conflict with gangs running amok, and with the collaboration, unfortunately, effectors of the police and army in Mexico. So while it doesn't threaten the regime, it's certainly not a strictly secure environment if you want to travel around the country.
Well, Professor Petras, you paint a vivid portrait of a continent, really, that has solid economic growth and perhaps even greater economic potential, and yet for all of that, is in the much of the North American and European media, Latin America is still portrayed not even so much as a backwater, so much as something that's simply excluded from the conversation altogether. It seems to be something that's largely ignored. Why do you think this is? Is this just an extension of imperial hubris?
Well, I think it's, we talk about the U.S. media. Since the U.S. government has focused on the Middle East and military warfare, the economic dimensions of overseas U.S. Activity, global involvement has been eclipsed. And secondly, because Latin America no longer is dependent on external financing, they're self-financing through their earnings, the IMF has less of a role, U.S. Commercial banks. But Wall Street has poured money into Peru, has poured money into Chile, is certainly involved heavily in Brazil. So I think it's partly a result of Washington and the media rather than some kind of myopia in terms of general public. The Washington has really sacrificed its economic interests by engaging in wars in the Middle East, particularly the influence of the Israeli lobby here and getting the U.S. involved in Iraq, putting sanctions on Iran, and engaging in clandestine wars in Syria and Libya, etc. These are trillion-dollar losses, not to speak of Afghanistan, bombings in Pakistan. All this kind of militarism has weakened the use of American resources to further market shares and investment shares in Latin America. And I think that this is one of the reasons that Latin America doesn't get the publicity. Look, I did studies in the New York Times and even the Wall Street Journal on coverage of Brazil versus Israel, and Israel wins by about a 5-1 margin. And, you know, Israel is a speck, a fly speck on the panoramic window. If you compare the economies of Israel and Brazil, in terms of industrialization, exports, the revenues, consumer markets, etc. So there's a certain bias into that's built into the pro-Israel crowd and that controls the media here that skews coverage and misinforms the public.
And leaping into that gap, of course, these days is, as you point out, many of the Asia-Pacific nations that are so interested.
Asia-Pacific is one of the big factors that's linked up with Latin America. Latin America is opening relations with Iran. They're expanding their ties with Asia, joint ventures. They are looking toward greater relationships in Central Asia. They are maintaining ties with Europe and signed off on several major trade agreements, despite Europe's very stagnant, recessive economies. So you have a new set of indicators of where Latin America is going. If the U.S. is going to, quote, pivot on the Middle East, going to respond to Zionist influence in setting economic priorities. Sanctions don't help the U.S. economy. Sanctions don't raise the profile of the U.S. economy. It cuts out business, hundreds of billions of dollars have been lost in relationship to Iraq, Iran, the restrictions and some of the sales to Syria, and what damage they did to Lebanon, prejudicing major oil deals that were pending. It's a disaster from an economic point of view, a military point of view, a strategic point of view, from the point of view of U.S. economic growth and influence. The only beneficiary is Israel, that has the U.S. doing yeoman's work and weakening it, the adversaries of land grabs in Palestinian territories.
Well, then let's talk about some of the ways that the region can go from here. And one of the bodies that was set up in 2008 was UNISER, the Union of South American Nations, which at the time was envisioned to be some sort of Latin American answer, perhaps, potentially to the European Union. But as we've seen, of course, the European Union is now a basket case that seems destined for the dustbin of history. And the question of whether the South American nations would want to repeat that is certainly one to ponder. Where do you think bodies like UNISER and Mercosur are going at this point, and where do you think the region will develop in terms of fostering internal ties?
Well, Jimmy, I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's the other pole of growth in Latin America. There's been a substantial increase in inter-regional trade, Latin American integration, trade between the major countries in Mercosur, particularly Argentina, Brazil, Uruguay, now Venezuela is part of that. There's a number of indicators of substantial growth of interregional trade, interregional investment. Colombia has moved closer to Venezuela in terms of complementary economies between food and manufacturing exports from Colombia. Yeah, that $8 or $9 billion a year with Venezuela, which depends on food imports and finished goods in exchange for petroleum products. So I think this is really one of the dynamic poles in Latin America, even as overseas exports continue to be major factors. So I think while political integration is moving slowly, economic integration and exchanges have been increasing. And I would also mention this, that we can't underestimate, because of the social expenditures, the domestic market in Latin America, particularly in places like Brazil and Argentina, is another dynamic economic pole. That is, the increase in consumer power, the lowering of interest rates and borrowing for personal spending, household expenditures has increased. So you have booming demand in Asia, you have a greater south-south trade, and you have dynamic regional trade, and you have a growing domestic market. And all those factors have compensated for the stagnation in Europe and the militarization of U.S. Global policy. So I think we have a changing profile for Latin America.
Does this coincide with a larger shift in global geopolitics generally, that's seeing a shift away from U.S. and Europe as the power centers of the global stage?
Well, that's very clear. Asia, as a matter of fact, China is now a major growth engine in the world economy, and it's looked at by even the most conservative financial commentators. That's one aspect. Two, regionally, Brazil is playing an important role in eclipsing some of the U.S. Influence. We're getting into a poly-centric economic world, and while the U.S. is bent on retaining military superiority, as the military bases expand, the economic reach of the U.S. has declined. And the same goes in terms of domestic. As militarism expands abroad, the domestic economy decline. So you have two things going for against the U.S. One is the decline of the domestic economy, income, spending, investment, productivity, innovation, imbalances in the economy between the financial, real estate, and insurance sector, what we call the FIRE economy, and the productive economy, the manufacturing and productive goods. And the obsession by, just listen to this debate on the sequester. Obama pitches in terms of what it's going to do to the military budget. Now, if, in fact, there was a big cutback in military spending, and if the savings were channeled back into production, it wouldn't be a bad thing. And the fact that the debate from the Obama White House to the Republicans is, look, what you're endangering the military operations overseas of the United States, gives you an indication of the perverse thought. It's precisely the channeling of productive resources and revenues to a very costly, cost-inefficient military that has hindered the U.S. from regaining any market shares.
Well, then, just before we finish this conversation, I know this is on a somewhat unrelated topic, but I couldn't let you go without commenting on a very interesting article you wrote towards the end of last year called Legal Imperialism and International Law, Legal Foundations for War Crimes, Debt Collection, and Colonization, in which you point out that, in fact, although the charge that the imperial powers are often called lawless is often leveled at those powers, it's in fact something of a misnomer insofar as these imperial powers are really following imperial jurisprudence. Perhaps you could explain a little bit about what you mean by that term and what this really is about.
The U.S. Foreign policy and involvement in overseas relations has been judged by international law and the Geneva Agreements, some of the international court rulings, etc. And on the basis of that, they find correctly there's been a tremendous degree of violations, violations of sovereignty, violations of human rights, crimes against humanity, etc. And so people say it's lawless. But in the United States, legal doctrines have been pronounced either through executive prerogatives, assertions of executive prerogatives based on consultation with legal scholars, a minority to be sure, that provide a body of legal doctrine that justifies that strengthens executive prerogative power. And in other words, they've constructed a parallel and conflicting legal doctrine, which is an attempt to justify presidential orders that sanction the killing of American citizens without trial or court processes, judicial processes. There's laws that justify illegal wiretapping or intrusions into private homes, arbitrary arrests, as well as publicly sanctioned assassinations. In other words, what we have is an imperial legal doctrine which says this takes supremacy. Our law, our imperial laws take precedence and supremacy over the international body of legal doctrine. And that's exactly the way in which imperial powers operate. They fashion the laws that are convenient and in accord with their imperial aspirations and interests, rather than any independent body of thought which has gone through what we might call international jurisprudence.
Well, then what are the implications of this for victims of the war crimes of these imperial powers to ever achieve justice for those crimes?
Well, they have several recourse. Some of them go through the international court processes, and they have problems there because some of these judges in The Hague and elsewhere are appointed by or influenced by the imperial powers themselves. So it's very difficult terrain. But let's assume that they get the relatively independent judges. They get decisions which condemn imperial powers, but they don't have mechanisms of enforcement. The imperial powers simply ignore them and go about their business. There is interference in these processes, but the claimants, the victims, can get a moral victory. And in cases where the imperial powers themselves are not directly affected, say that the a client regime of an imperial power engages in certain criminal offenses, violating international law, they can be condemned. Second-level powers, in other words, who are collaborators of empire, have on occasion been charged with crimes against humanity, etc. You have the moral approval and judgments, which can serve to perhaps influence certain publics in the imperial countries and can initiate some internal judicial processes which can challenge this power. The issue of the drones, for example, starts from the outside. There's some Geneva agreements that condemn it, and that has an impact on legal bodies in the United States, the ACLU, Center for Constitutional Studies. These, in turn, influence certain congressmen, opinion leaders in the United States, who then raise issues, congressional issues, with the executive. And that indirectly can have an effect in either modifying or limiting or forcing the government on a defensive footing.
A fascinating discussion, but I think we're going to have to leave it there for today. But before we go, Professor Petras, can you tell people where they can go to find out more about yourself and your work?
Well, they can go on my website, James Lahane, H-A-I-N-E, James Petras official website, and they can find all my articles, interviews, and even photos if anyone's interested in, on my website. I've had about 6.5 million readers in the last 6 years, so we're doing quite well, and everyone's welcome to consult and visit.
All right. Well, I will put the link in the show notes for this interview for those who are interested. So once again, James Petras, thank you very much for your time today.
Oh, James, where do you broadcast to?
Well, it's on the internet, so it's worldwide.
Oh, okay. Very good. Well, good luck in your work.
Thank you very much.
Bye.